Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. Washington's stated justification for the attack was based on one man. The United States' sole rationale for sending its young men and women to risk their lives and consciences, killing innocent people, including untold numbers of children, and setting fire to huge sections of Panama City, was Noriega. He was characterized as evil, as the enemy of the people, as a drug trafficking monster, and as such, he provided the administration with an excuse for the massive invasion of a country with 2 million inhabitants, which coincidentally happened to sit on one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the whole world. John found the invasion disturbing to the point of driving him into a depression that lasted many days. He knew that Noriega had bodyguards, yet he could not help believing that the jackals could have taken him out, as they had Roldos and Torrijos. Most of his bodyguards, John suspected, had been trained by U.S. military personnel and probably could have been paid either to look the other way or to carry out an assassination themselves. The more John thought and read about the invasion, the more convinced he became that it signaled a U.S. policy turn back toward the old methods of empire building, that the Bush administration was determined to go one better than Reagan and to demonstrate to the world that it would not hesitate to use massive force in order to achieve its ends. It also seemed that the goal in Panama, in addition to replacing the Torrijos legacy with a puppet administration favorable to the United States, was to frighten countries like Iraq into submission. David Harris, a contributing editor of the New York Times Magazine and the author of many books, has an interesting observation. In his 2001 book, Shooting the Moon, he states, quote, "Of all the thousands of rulers, potentates, strongmen, juntas, and warlords the Americans have dealt with in all corners of the world, General Manuel Antonio Noriega is the only one the Americans came after like this. Just once in its 225 years of formal national existence has the United States either invaded another country and carried its ruler back to the United States to face trial and imprisonment for violations of American law committed on the ruler's own native foreign turf. End quote. Following the bombardment, the United States suddenly found itself in a delicate situation. For a while, it seemed as though the whole thing would backfire. The Bush administration might have quashed the wimp rumors, but now it faced the problem of legitimacy, of appearing to be a bully caught in an act of terrorism. It was disclosed that the U.S. Army had prohibited the press, the Red Cross, and other outside observers from entering the heavily bombed areas for 3 days, while soldiers incinerated and buried the casualties. The press asked questions about how much evidence of criminal and other inappropriate behavior was destroyed, and how many died because they were denied timely medical attention, but such questions were never answered. The people shall never know many of the facts about the invasion, nor shall they know the true extent of the massacre. Defense Secretary Richard Cheney claimed a death toll between 500 and 600, but independent human rights groups estimated it at 3,000 to 5,000, with another 25,000 left homeless. Noriega was arrested, flown to Miami, and sentenced to 40 years imprisonment. At that time, he was the only person in the United States officially classified as a prisoner of war. The world was outraged by this breach of international law and by the needless destruction of a defenseless people at the hands of the most powerful military force on the planet. But few in the United States were aware of either the outrage or the crimes Washington had committed. Press coverage was very limited. A number of factors contributed to this, including government policy, White House phone calls to publishers and television executives, congresspeople who dared not object, lest the wimp factor become their problem, and journalists who thought the public needed heroes rather than objectivity. One exception was Peter Eisner, a Newsday editor, an Associated Press reporter who covered the Panama invasion and continued to analyze it for many years. In The Memoirs of Manuel Noriega, America's Prisoner, published in 1997, Eisner writes, quote, "The death, destruction, and injustice wrought in the name of fighting Noriega, and the lies surrounding that event, were threats to the basic American principles of democracy. Soldiers were ordered to kill in Panama, and they did so after being told they had to rescue a country from the clamp of a cruel, depraved dictator. Once they acted, the people of their country, the U.S., marched lockstep behind them." End quote. After lengthy research, including interviews with Noriega in his Miami prison cell, Eisner states, quote, "On the key points, I do not think the evidence shows Noriega was guilty of the charges against him. I do not think his actions as a foreign military leader or a sovereign head of state justified the invasion of Panama, or that he represented a threat to U.S. national security." And Eisner concludes, quote, "My analysis of the political situation and my reporting in Panama before, during, and after the invasion brought me to the conclusion that the U.S. invasion of Panama was an abominable abuse of power. The invasion principally serves the goals of arrogant American politicians and their Panamanian allies at the expense of unconscionable bloodshed." End quote. The Arias family and the Pretorios oligarchy, which had served as U.S. puppets from the time when Panama was torn from Colombia until Torrijos took over, were reinstated. The new canal treaty became a moot point. In essence, Washington once again controlled the waterway, despite anything the official documents said. And I will come back to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. As John reflected on those incidents and all that he had experienced while working for Maine, he found himself asking the same questions over and over. How many decisions, including ones of great historical significance that impact millions of people, are made by men and women who are driven by personal motives rather than by a desire to do the right thing? How many of our top government officials are driven by personal greed instead of national loyalty? How many wars are fought because a president does not want his constituents to perceive him as a wimp? Despite John's promises to SWEC's president, his frustration and feelings of impotence about the Panama invasion prodded him into resuming work on his book, except now he decided to focus on Torrijos. He saw Torrijos' story as a way to expose many of the injustices that infect our world and as a way to rid himself of his guilt. This time, however, he was determined to keep silent about what he was doing, rather than seeking advice from friends and peers. As John worked on the book, he was stunned by the magnitude of what the economic hitmen had accomplished in so many places. He tried to concentrate on a few countries that stood out, but the list of places where he had worked and which were worse off afterwards was astounding. He also was horrified by the extent of his own corruption. He had done a great deal of soul-searching, yet he realized that while he was in the midst of it, he had been so focused on his daily activities that he had not seen the larger perspective. Thus, when he was in Indonesia, he fretted over things Howard Parker and he had discussed, or the issues raised by Rassi's young Indonesian friends. While he was working in Panama, he was deeply affected by the implications of what he had seen during Fidel's introduction of the slums, the canal zone, and the discotheque. In Iran, his conversations with Yamin and Doc troubled him immensely. Now, the act of writing this book gave him an overview. He understood how easy it had been not to see the larger picture, and therefore to miss the true significance of his actions. How simple this sounds and how self-evident, yet how insidious the nature of these experiences. For John, it conjures the image of a soldier. In the beginning, he is naive. He may question the morality of killing other people, but mostly he has to deal with his own fear, has to focus on survival. After he kills his first enemy, he is overwhelmed with emotions. He may wonder about the family of the dead man and feel a sense of remorse. Yet, as time goes on and he participates in more battles, kills more people, he becomes hardened. He is transformed into a professional soldier. John had become a professional soldier. Admitting the fact opened the door for a better understanding of the process by which crimes are committed and empires are built. He could now comprehend why so many people have committed atrocious acts, how, for example, good, family-loving Iranians could work for the Shah's brutal secret police, how good Germans could follow the orders of Hitler, how good American men and women could bomb Panama City. As an EHM, John never drew a penny directly from the NSA or other government agency. Maine paid his salary. He was a private citizen, employed by a private corporation. Understanding this helped him see more clearly the emerging role of the corporate executive as EHM. A whole new class of soldiers was emerging on the world scene, and these people were becoming desensitized to their own actions. John wrote, quote, "Today, men and women are going into Thailand, the Philippines, Botswana, Bolivia, and every other country where they hope to find people desperate for work. They go to these places with the express purpose of exploiting wretched people, people whose children are severely malnourished, even starving, people who live in shanty towns and have lost all hope of a better life, people who have ceased to even dream of another day. These men and women leave their plush offices in Manhattan or San Francisco or Chicago, streak across continents and oceans in luxurious jetliners, check into first-class hotels, and dine at the finest restaurants the country has to offer. Then they go searching for desperate people. Today, we still have slave traders. They no longer find it necessary to march into the forests of Africa looking for prime specimens who will bring top dollar on the auction blocks in Charleston, Cartagena, and Havana. They simply recruit desperate people and build a factory to produce the jackets, blue jeans, tennis shoes, automobile parts, computer components, and thousands of other items they can sell in the markets of their choosing. Or they may elect not even to own the factory themselves. Instead, they hire a local businessman to do all their dirty work for them. These men and women think of themselves as upright. They return to their homes with photographs of quaint sites and ancient ruins to show to their children. They attend seminars where they pat each other on the back and exchange tidbits of advice about dealing with the eccentricities of customs in far-off lands. Their bosses hire lawyers who assure them that what they are doing is perfectly legal. They have a cadre of psychotherapists and other human resource experts at their disposal to convince them that they are helping these desperate people. The old-fashioned slave trader told himself that he was dealing with a species that was not entirely human, and that he was offering them the opportunity to become Christianized. He also understood that slaves were fundamental to the survival of his own society, and that they were the foundation of his economy. The modern slave trader assures herself that the desperate people are better off earning $1 a day than no dollars at all, and that they are receiving the opportunity to become integrated into the larger world community. She also understands that these desperate people are fundamental to the survival of her company, and they are the foundation for her own lifestyle. She never stops to think about the larger implications of what she, her lifestyle, and the economic system behind them are doing to the world, or how they may ultimately impact her children's future." End quote. And from here, John Perkins goes on to discuss an economic hitman failure in Iraq. His role as president of IPS in the 1980s and as a consultant to SWEC in the late 1980s and throughout much of the 1990s, gave him access to information about Iraq that was not available to most people. Indeed, during the 1980s, the majority of Americans knew little about the country. It was not on their radar screen. However, John was fascinated by what was going on there. He kept in touch with old friends who worked for the World Bank, USAID, and IMF, or one of the other international financial organizations, and with people at Bechtel, Halliburton, and the other major engineering and construction companies, including his own father-in-law. Many of the engineers employed by IPS, subcontractors, and other independent power companies were also involved in projects in the Middle East. John was very aware that EHMs were hard at work in Iraq. The Reagan and Bush administrations were determined to turn Iraq into another Saudi Arabia. There were many compelling reasons for Saddam Hussein to follow the example of the House of Saud. He had only to observe the benefits they had reaped from the money laundering affair. Since the deal was struck, modern cities had risen from the Saudi desert. Riyadh's garbage collecting goats had been transformed into sleek trucks, and now the Saudis enjoyed the fruits of some of the most advanced technologies in the world: state-of-the-art desalinization plants, sewage treatment systems, communications networks, and electric utility grids. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Saddam Hussein undoubtedly was aware that the Saudis also enjoyed special treatment when it came to matters of international law. Their good friends in Washington turned a blind eye to many Saudi activities, including the financing of fanatical groups, many of which were considered by most of the world to be radicals bordering on terrorism, and the harboring of international fugitives. In fact, the United States actively sought and received Saudi Arabian financial support for Osama bin Laden's Afghan war against the Soviet Union. The Reagan and Bush administrations not only encouraged the Saudis in this regard, but also they pressured many other countries to do the same, or at least to look the other way. The EHM presence in Baghdad was very strong during the 1980s. They believed that Saddam eventually would see the light, and John had to agree with this assumption. After all, if Iraq reached an accord with Washington, similar to that of the Saudis, Saddam could basically write his own ticket in ruling his country, and might even expand his circle of influence throughout that part of the world. It hardly mattered that he was a pathological tyrant, that he had the blood of mass murderers on his hands, or that his mannerisms and brutal actions conjured images of Adolf Hitler. The United States had tolerated and even supported such men many times before. The U.S. would be happy to offer him U.S. government securities in exchange for petrodollars, for the promise of continued oil supplies, and for a deal whereby the interest on those securities was used to hire U.S. companies to improve infrastructure systems throughout Iraq, to create new cities, and to turn the deserts into oases. The U.S. would be willing to sell him tanks and fighter planes and to build him chemical and nuclear power plants, as they had done in so many other countries, even if these technologies could conceivably be used to produce advanced weaponry. Iraq was extremely important to the United States, much more important than was obvious on the surface. Contrary to common public opinion, Iraq is not simply about oil. It is also about water and geopolitics. Both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers flow through Iraq. Thus, of all the countries in that part of the world, Iraq controls the most important sources of increasingly critical water resources. During the 1980s, the importance of water, politically as well as economically, was becoming obvious to those in the energy and engineering fields. In the rush toward privatization, many of the major companies that had set their rights on taking over the small independent power companies now looked toward privatizing water systems in Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. In addition to oil and water, Iraq is situated in a very strategic location. It borders Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey, and it has a coastline on the Persian Gulf. It is within easy missile-striking distance of both Israel and the former Soviet Union. Military strategists equate modern Iraq to the Hudson River Valley during the French and Indian War and the American Revolution. In the 18th century, the French, British, and Americans knew that whoever controlled the Hudson River Valley controlled the continent. Today, it is common knowledge that whoever controls Iraq holds the key to controlling the Middle East. Above all else, Iraq presented a vast market for American technology and engineering expertise. The fact that it sits atop one of the world's most extensive oil fields, by some estimates even greater than Saudi Arabia's, assured that it was in a position to finance huge infrastructure and industrialization programs. all the major players, engineering and construction companies, computer systems, suppliers, aircraft, missile, and tank manufacturers, and pharmaceutical and chemical companies were focused on Iraq. However, by the late 1980s, it was apparent that Saddam was not buying into the economic hitman scenario. This was a major frustration and a great embarrassment to the first Bush administration. Like Panama, Iraq contributed to George H.W. Bush's wimp image. As Bush searched for a way out, Saddam played into his hands. In August of 1990, he invaded the oil-rich Sheikhdom of Kuwait. Bush responded with a denunciation of Saddam for violating international law, even though it had been less than a year since Bush himself had staged the illegal and unilateral invasion of Panama. It was no surprise when the president finally ordered an all-out military attack. 500,000 U.S. troops were sent in as part of an international force. During the early months of 1991, an aerial assault was launched against Iraqi military and civilian targets. It was followed by a 100-hour land assault that routed the outgunned and desperately inferior Iraqi army. Kuwait was safe. A true despot had been chastised, though not brought to justice. Bush's popularity ratings soared to 90% among the American people. John was in Boston attending meetings at the time of the Iraq invasion, one of the few occasions when he was actually asked to do something for SWEC. John vividly recalls the enthusiasm that greeted Bush's decision. Naturally, people throughout the Stone and Webster organization were excited, though not only because they had taken a stand against a murderous dictator. For them, a U.S. victory in Iraq offered possibilities for huge profits, promotions, and raises. The excitement was not limited to those in business that would directly benefit from war. People across the nation seemed almost desperate to see the U.S. assert itself militarily. John believed there were many reasons for this attitude, including the philosophical change that occurred when Reagan defeated Carter, the Iranian hostages were released, and Reagan announced his intention to renegotiate the Panama Canal Treaty. Bush's invasion of Panama stirred the already smoldering flames. Beneath the patriotic rhetoric and the calls for action, however, John believes a much more subtle transformation was occurring in the way U.S. commercial interests, and therefore most of the people who worked for American corporations, viewed the world. The march toward global empire had become a reality in which much of the country participated. The dual ideas of globalization and privatization were making significant inroads into U.S. psyches. In the final analysis, this was not solely about the United States. The global empire had become just that. It reached across all borders. What were now truly international, even from a legal standpoint? Many of them were incorporated in a multitude of countries. They could pick and choose from an assortment of rules and regulations under which to conduct their activities. And a multitude of globalizing trade agreements and organizations made this even easier. Words like democracy, socialism, and capitalism were becoming almost obsolete. Corporatocracy had become a fact, and it increasingly exerted itself as the major influence on world economics and politics. And I will continue Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.